when I was a kid, I would pretend I was shooting a free throw or whatever I was doing. And this is for the NCAA championship, or this is for the NBA title, game seven or whatever. And then I played in the Final Four and I was shooting a free throw, thinking about, this is no different than being in my backyard. I can't believe that was the thought in my mind.
And welcome back. Welcome aboard another Partrain. I am Evan, and Serm couldn't join me. He had some stuff he had to take care of. So I flew solo today with one of my favorite guests we've had over the years, his second ride on the train, Jay Billis. You know him well from the world of college basketball, and he's a big golfer. We'll get to that in a second, but in case you guys are new, we help frustrated golfers enjoy the ride again, because if you can learn to smile through bad golf, you can smile through anything. We unpack the mental game with anyone from a PGA Tour pro to a sportscaster like today with Jay Billis. And before we get to this interview with Jay, which you guys are going to absolutely love, a quick word from our friends at Roback. I'm wearing the new navy hoodie right now. They just dropped the new kind of hoodie. It's kind of a t-shirt hoodie. So if you want something that has a hood, that's long sleeve, that's breathable, but you can wear and stay active to the gym, on errands, maybe even under a golf polo, I think this is a great option. They release new styles and new products, it seems like, every week. So go to roback.com, enter the code TRAIN, get 15% off. I personally love the polos and the crew necks the best, but really everything they make is top-notch and amazing quality. I've had people ask me, plus $100 for a hoodie? And I'm like, well, first of all, you get 15% with our code TRAIN. But second of all, if it's the first thing you wear out of the laundry, and you travel with it, and you play golf in it, and you work out with it, and you walk around town with it, it's probably worth it, right? That's how I view it. I want versatility and things that I can wear in multiple situations to make the money worth it. And you deserve to wear quality stuff. You deserve to feel comfortable and feel good. So roback.com, enter the code TRAIN, 50% off. All right. This episode with Jay, you'll hear me talk about at the beginning, I actually played with one of his childhood friends when I was invited to a private club down in Palos Verdes. Shout out Steve. And I was like, I should reach back out to Jay and tell him how much I enjoyed meeting his friend Steve. And we were lucky enough to get him back on the podcast right before he goes into March craziness with college basketball and the NCAA tournament. So what I love about a second interview with a guest like Jay is, in the first interview, you've heard us say this before, but I'll say it again. You know, I want to do you guys, my passengers, a service by covering as much as I can, right? Some basketball talk, some golf talk, Coach K stuff. If you want to listen to that, the first interview with Jay Billis tackles all of that. It was a great interview. But interview two is sometimes my favorite one, because I can go really deep on one topic. And today we went really deep on his game. He went from, and I can really relate to this now that I'm doing the same thing. When COVID hit, he took a lesson a week for a year. And we talk about what he learned and how his enjoyment of the game has skyrocketed. But what's great about this interview and what's so relatable about it is he also talks about his greatest struggles on the greens and how he's reached such new heights in his ball striking. It's really exposed his putting. And we talk about it. He's totally real. I think this interview can help a lot of people, and it's very relatable. So if you guys like the podcast, do us a solid, give us a review at Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Spotify. If you listen on Spotify, it really helps. And don't forget to hop aboard our YouTube channel at The Partrain, youtube.com/@ThePartrain. These podcasts are going up in video form every Monday on our channel, as well as I'm doing more and more videos designed particularly for YouTube. So it's a big focus for us moving forward. I can't wait to help you guys enjoy the ride through video form as well as the podcast. No matter where your ball goes, no matter what your handicap is, no matter how many putts you've missed in a short range, just enjoy the ride, guys. Take care. Jay Billis, welcome aboard the Partrain for your second ride. We're pumped to have you.
I'm pumped to be here. Thanks for having me. It's always nice to talk about walking on grass and golf and get me away from that hardwood stuff I'm immersed in.
Especially this time of year, this is a rare conversation for you. So it's probably a refreshing little change of pace, I would imagine.
Yeah, but even when I'm not playing golf, I'm thinking about it. So, you know, even on the sidelines of a game, I'm working on my grip or something.
I just changed my grip. It's a funny game and it's a small world, right, Jay? We've stayed in touch over the years, but it's been about 3.5 years since you've been on the show. And then oddly enough, I get invited to play Rolling Hills Country Club down in Palos Verdes. And I meet a guy named Steve. And he tells me, you know, somehow your name comes up and you guys are childhood friends. And I've never met a guy, I want to start off with Steve today, Jay. I've never met a guy who was more willing and generous with steak. I felt like it was a drug deal. Okay. This, I'm not going to say exactly what grocery chain, but your friend Steve runs a big grocery chain. And he kept telling me, hey, what kind of steak do you want? I'll have it waiting for you. So I walk into the grocery, I tell them my name, and they just hand me a bag of two Wagyu grass-fed New York strips. And I walk out like it was a drug deal. I've never experienced anything like it. What a guy. What a way to get brought back together.
Yeah, well, Steve and I grew up together, and there is a method to that, because every time I'm out in California, you know, I get together with Steve and a lot of our other high school friends. But Steve's always, you know, it's usually during July. He's like, tell me what you need for July 4th, if you need anything. And he has it all set up. But he knows when you go into that grocery store, you're going to go back because it's so good. So, I mean, he knows what he's doing, but he is a generous guy. We've known each other, I don't know, for how many years now, over 40 years. And you're not going to find a better guy. The only thing we've never connected on is he is a huge Grateful Dead guy.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I don't turn the Dead off, but I ain't looking for it. It doesn't connect with me the way it does for him. And he and other friends of ours, they travel around the country going to Dead shows, and they've been doing that for 40 plus years.
Yeah. I actually played with three Deadheads that day. I was the only one.
How excruciating.
Who do you think is more passionate, Deadheads or golfers?
It's pretty close. It's very similar, because the Deadheads will travel just as far as we will to play a great place. They'll go to see the Dead anywhere.
Right.
And Steve, all the time, he's at a Dead show, and he goes to Bill Walton, and they take a picture and send it to me, usually with their middle fingers up. But they love it. I mean, I think that's a close call. That's a really good comparison.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. We're also talking on Leap Day today. This is going to come out later, but I did a post on Instagram that went viral, that was basically like, everyone should go play golf on Leap Day, because something crazy is going to happen. Something magical will happen. And yet, didn't expect it. I'm talking with you again on this day. So happy Leap Day to you, Jay, before we dig in everything.
Well, happy Leap Day. But this sort of contradicts your something great will happen thing for you. This isn't great for you.
Well, you know, Jay, a lot's happened since October 2020. I've met my Wendy. Obviously, my wife is named Tara, but I've met and got married since Matt got married recently as well. A lot has changed, but some things never change. And I was talking to one of the top coaches in golf recently, and he made a basketball analogy of why golf is probably the hardest sport mentally. I want to get your take on it to start today. We talked about the concept of dispersion and how a really bad shot might miss the rim, but it might miss the rim by an inch. Most of your misses are hitting the rim, right? Whereas golf, your biggest miss, even for the best players in the world, might be 60 yards, 50 yards. Do you connect with that dispersion of misses leads to why golf might be the hardest sport to deal with mentally?
Oh, yeah. I don't know if I would have gone to dispersion. Golf is, in my view, the hardest sport mentally that I've ever encountered, and it's way harder than basketball. The only time in a basketball context that you have to think is when you're shooting a free throw. So free throws, I think, compare favorably to things that you do in golf, because you have to stop and think, and it's really easy to get in your own head, I think, when you do that. That's why there are some players that may struggle at times from the free throw line. It differs. And the one thing that's different about free throws and, say, a 5-foot putt, every 5-foot putt is different. You know, the conditions are different. You know, you got different terrain, you know, grass, whatever. You haven't take a lot of variables into account. In basketball, it's always 15 feet. There's no wind blowing. You may have a different background in a different gym that you play in, but that's about it. There's very few variables in that. But routine in both free throw shooting and putting or anything in golf is important. And then sort of your mental frame of mind, like, do you step up? I always think about, you know, when I'm struggling putting, which is a lot of times it comes from, I step over the putt, not wanting to miss it.
Yeah.
Instead of step on there to make it.
Yeah.
Like Steve Kerr told me this one time, you know, Steve and I played golf together. He's a really good friend. And I think one of the true good guys in sports. And Steve one time was talking about when he was a basketball player, when things kind of got their best for him, or the best for him, was when he just convinced himself that, look, every shot I take, I may miss. And I have to accept the consequences that come with missing and not be worried about it, that I may miss. Like every putt you step over, it might be a 2-footer, it might be you may miss.
Yeah.
But you can't worry about missing. You'll deal with the consequences of a miss afterwards. And he, you know, you have to step up there with the mindset, like, I'm only thinking about making this. I'm not afraid of the outcome. And that's what competitors do. True competitors. Everybody says they're a competitor, but the true competitors do that. And then what I've always struggled with, you know, I played basketball for Coach K, and I was an assistant on his staff. I mean, I've known him for 40 plus years. And he always used to say next play to us all the time, like, move on, next play. Something happens, you got to move on. We'll analyze this stuff later, like, move on. And that's, I wish I had played golf seriously when I was a little kid, because if I did, I think I would have been a better basketball player, because there's nothing more important, I think, in golf than accepting what just happened and thinking about what's the right thing to do now. Like, I can beat myself up over knocking it 30 yards right into the woods, but I'm still here. So right. Now the thing is, how do I get it out and make the best score from here? I'm here now. So, I mean, why am I carrying my bad tee shot with me? That's not helping me. And right. But that's hard to do. At least it's hard for me. And I can't imagine what it's like for pros whose margin, their dispersion is a lot more acceptable than mine. And they make a tiny little mistake, they probably know they're not going to do it again. I'm worried that I'm going to, but that the mental challenge is the whole game to me now. I've gotten better at a lot of things over the last 2-3 years. I've worked on it, and I'm in the best place I've ever been as a golfer, but I'm not sure that the mental side is where it needs to be for me.
Well, we'll dig into that. I think I remember you saying your brother, that was what he was really good at last time we talked, which is
yeah.
He didn't worry that he was going to do the bad shot again. That's why he was able to move on so quickly. But he told you that you probably are. That's the difference between someone who gets upset and carries it with them after versus can move on quickly.
Yeah, my brother told me a lot of things. You know, one was with my driver. You know, he told me one time we're walking up the fairway, and he said, look, you know how far your 7-iron goes. You know how far your 8-iron goes. He goes, you think that driver's unlimited, and it's not. And he basically told me, like, what you need to start doing is when you're just playing on your own or something. I used to go out in the morning or at night and play by myself when I had the time. And he said, any shot you hit out of the fairway, then your automatic is you've got to chip it sideways back out in the middle of the fairway. Like that's got to be like your punishment for hitting a bad tee shot. Even if it's a yard off the fairway and you got a great line, a clear path to the green, you got to chip it sideways. Like, you need to concentrate on hitting the fairway. Like, what difference does it make whether you hit a 300 or 275? If you're in the fairway, you're in better shape. Like that's how you score. And the other thing was, you know, he never gets mad on a golf course. I've never seen him get mad. And he blew one right on the 7th hole at my course at Charlotte Country Club. And when I do that, you know, I'm like, and I carry it with me. And I said, geez, I would be pissed if I just did that. He hit it out of bounds, had hit another one. And he goes, the difference between you and me is I know I'm not going to do that again. Mm-hmm. And it made an impact on me. I still do it. I still get mad when I shouldn't, but because he's right. Like, I'm worried I'm going to do it again, and I shouldn't worry about it.
Well, I want to dig into how you've improved since we last talked. But first, you made me think of we've had Dr. Joe Parent, the author of Zen Golf, on the show a few times, and he told this great story that I think is actually really relevant. He said, ask someone, put a shot glass on a table about 5 feet away and tell them they have to shoot this quarter into the shot glass or it's a bad shot. What will people do? They'll start to get really guidey, right? They'll try and make it. But then if you take that same shot and you say, try and make it in the shot glass, but anywhere on the table is a good shot, they start really getting free and loose. And that, to me, is one of the best, I guess, descriptions of how to play golf, in your point of not being afraid to miss, but giving yourself some sort of freedom versus guiding, right?
Well, and that's tension. So yeah. Whether it's basketball was what it's what I think I know best. I may not know it, but I know it better than anything else. You know, I believe in basketball. I think it transfers pretty well to golf, is that tension is the enemy of performance. So when you're stepping up to a free throw, obviously a free throw in the last minute of a game is going to be more tension filled than a free throw, you know, in the first half. You're not as worried about it. You know, you step up to one where you feel like this means winning or losing, you tense up and you're just not going to perform at as high a level that way. And it's hard to prepare yourself for that in practice, you know, where it's hard to simulate that. And that's where that's the mental side of it. And golf is a lot harder for me to do that because I don't feel like I'm as competent a golfer as I was a basketball player. And that's part of it. I'm getting better at it, but it still comes out, you know, in a member guest or in a tournament you're playing in. All of a sudden, like stuff you do generally when you're playing with your friends and a round of 20 bucks is on the line, you know, you feel different. You know, all of a sudden I'm tensed up in a different way and there's no way I'm going to perform at as high a level.
So I know what are some keys when you're over a short putt and you feel tension and you got to refocus on something productive. What is that for a basketball player in a free throw? Is it the routine? Is it a feel in the release? Is it the elbow? Like what was your key if you had a free throw and you feel the tension down the stretch?
Yeah, it's routine is one. The other is just a kind of calming yourself down part. I found this really bizarre and interesting. So when I was a kid playing basketball, I would shoot out in the backyard and, you know, you're shooting just like in golf. If you're on the putting green, you're pretending, all right, this 10 footers to win the Masters or something like that. Everybody's been through that, you know? And so when I was a kid, I would pretend I was shooting a free throw or whatever I was doing. And this is for the NCAA championship, or this is for the NBA title game 7 or whatever. And I would always think about, yeah, this is Final Four. I'm, you know, playing for UCLA when I was a kid or something like that. And then I played in the Final Four and I was shooting a free throw and I was thinking about being in my backyard. Like, this is no different than being in my backyard. And I thought that was, like, after the game, I was going, I can't believe that was the thought in my mind. Mm. Like I was just trying to tell myself, you've done this 1,000 times. Yeah, I've done it more than 1,000 times. You've done this 1,000,000 times or whatever it is. Like, this is no different than a free throw you take in your backyard, just to like calm yourself down, that don't make this about the world, you know, riding on it. I mean, yeah. I know it's important, but you know, I can execute this. So just execute it the way you should.
I love that. Well, I hear a lot of pro golfers say something very similarly, not making the moment too big. I've done this 1,000,000 times. So let's talk about how your game's improved. I think back in October 2020, you were a 7, and I saw you did pretty well at the pro member at Cherry Hills Country Club. So talk to me what you've been working on. Talk to me about the evolution since 2020.
Right around the pandemic, I had been for about maybe 2 years in a really bad position physically. Like, I had hurt my back and I didn't really know what to do about it. And so, I mean, I sought medical attention and everything, but I really didn't know how to deal with it. So I had gotten into this spot where I couldn't really turn and I couldn't play the way I wanted to play. And I made these adjustments to try to keep my back from really bothering me. You know, I'd play golf, I'd have to take a couple of days off because I was in pain, that kind of thing. And when the pandemic hit, I had all this time on my hands. And I went to my pro, assistant pro Jack Fields at Charlotte Country Club, who played at University of North Carolina. He's an All-American. He's like 5 foot nothing. And he and I we're teammates in that Cherry Hills pro member thing you're talking about. And so I went to him and I said, look, my back's so screwed up. I'm in bad shape. I got really steep. I mean, it was awful. And so I said, let's start over. And I said, I need something that's going to protect my back, all these different things. And he sent me to a TPI professional, mm-hmm. that Titleist Performance Institute, a guy named Jonathan Avalos. And so I started working with Jonathan, and I did it every day for over a year. And all of a sudden, the mobility stuff that I was doing, my back starts feeling better. I took a lesson a week during the pandemic for a full year.
Wow.
And worked on it. I still do it now during the winter. I try to get in. I can't get in once a week because of my basketball schedule, but I go and take a lesson. And my thing was, my rationalization for it, or my justification, I should say, was like, why go out and play a round of crappy golf and pay a caddy? I'll pay my pro to make me better. And I'll spend that time actually working on it. And over the course of that year, I got to where I felt competent again. I got back down to like a 4 handicap, and I felt like I was in control of what I was doing, and at least way more so. And I've seen really steady improvement. I just now I need to get a putting lesson once a week because my putting's all over the place, but I feel a lot better over the ball. I'm healthy now. Like, I have no back pain to speak of other than the old man stiffness that guys my age get. And to me, it was a great lesson of, man, go see your PGA professional. And I'm not going to work it out by myself just by banging 1,000 balls. I need somebody to teach me how to practice, what to work on. And I've seen tremendous gains as a result of it. And I don't think it's been, I don't look at it as hard work. I mean, it's been really fun. And especially when you see benefits. You know, I put a new wing on Jack's house, and he's probably bought a Lamborghini with what I've paid him, but it's been worth every penny.
The train's going to make a quick stop. Stay seated. We'll get you right back to the show. But first, I just wanted to ask you guys, what do you really look for in the stuff that you wear on the golf course, off the golf course? I'm going to give you one word, and that's all you got to keep in mind. You got to make sure your clothes check this box: versatile. If the stuff you buy isn't versatile, then why are we buying it, right? I'm going to get you to buy high quality stuff. You deserve it. You deserve to feel comfortable and feel good in everything you wear. But I know that sometimes that ain't cheap. So here's what I'm going to do for you. First of all, you're going to click the link in our show notes or go to our Instagram at the Partrain. You'll see a little rowback link in there. You tap on that link. You'll get 50% auto applied in your cart. No need to remember a code. It just auto applies in your cart. You can tap the show notes or the link in our bio at the Partrain on Instagram. Now, the one word you need to know is versatile, because it's worth it to get yourself high quality athleisure gear if you can wear it on the range, in a meeting, bopping around town, in a workout, lounging on the couch. I'm literally wearing all rowback today, and I'm going to a car dealership. I'm going to a coffee shop. I'm going to go to the driving range after. Might even play 9 holes. We'll see. And I'm going to wear the same outfit, all rowback. So tap that link in our show notes of this episode. You'll see a rowback link. It'll auto apply in your cart, or head over to our Instagram at the Partrain and tap that rowback link and it'll auto apply in your cart. You guys deserve it. Get yourself some gear that makes you feel good, that's soft and stretchy. Rowback's the best. They've been with us since the beginning. We couldn't do the show without them. So show rowback that you want to hop aboard that rowback train so we can keep that partnership going and keep you guys enjoying the ride. All right, let's get back to the show.
This is very funny timing because I recently committed to doing the same thing. Serm, my co-host who couldn't be here today, we both decided to do a goals podcast at the beginning of the year, as you do. And my goal was stop changing stuff every week to try and find something. I'm not going to change anything unless I have a coach with me that approves it. And I'm going to work with a coach every 2 weeks. And I'm not going to try and figure this out on my own. It's too hard. And my game has gotten worse as our platform has grown. And I had a lot of self-doubt and I was trying to fix stuff. And then there was all this this shame of like, I have all this access and I'm getting worse. What is wrong with me type stuff, right? So I just recently did the same thing and I'm starting to, I've only had four lessons, but I'm already starting to be blown away by how many times I was trying to fix something the wrong way or fix something that didn't need to be fixed. So I'd love to dig into this more because I'm going through it now. Where did you guys start? What did he rebuild? What was the focus point? What did you guys do every week that got you down to a four?
First, we diagnosed what my main problems were so that we could address them. And we did it, I would call it systematically. So the first thing was I had gotten, to try to protect my back, I'd gotten so steep that there's no way I was going to hit the ball efficiently. And so we started working on getting it shallow. And so I worked really hard on just the shallow part of it. And that was the main part of my concentration in it. And as we got closer there, when shallowing became a more natural move, then we got into, getting through to the finished swing, kind of getting through the ball and getting onto my left side, stuff like that. But it's been a progression and Jack's been really patient. And I think I've been really patient in allowing him to build this the right way. And your point about I surrendered. Like I basically surrendered to Jack saying, I need help and I'll do whatever it takes. So help me through this. And the one thing I'll give myself a little bit of credit for, I give the rest of it to Jack, is that I kept going in there. Like good day, bad day, whatever. I kept going in there. And I wasn't going to invest, some of the time and then just quit. I was going to see it all the way through. And I don't think I actually believe it's going to be a never ending process in that regard. Not just to, keep, I mean, hopefully it'll keep getting better, but at least to maintain, what you've worked on to get to this point, cause you got to give yourself a little credit, like a four handicap isn't bad. It'd be nice to be a scratch golfer, but if I never get there, this pretty freaking enjoyable. I love this.
Still and a top percent, I would think.
Yeah, I can't get enough of it.
Yeah.
But I have to remind myself, like the guys that, the best players in the world get help all the time. And if they're doing it, like I'm exempt. Like that's stupid to think that way.
Right.
And with all the, and I, it's part of it was a financial decision for me. All the money I spend on golf, which I'm happy to do, it's a passion of mine. Why wouldn't I spend money in this area?
Mm-hmm.
And sort of because my enjoyment level has skyrocketed because of the gains I've seen and the gains I can still make even at my age. Like I think I can get significantly better from here, but I do need to make more. The one thing I do need to do now is make more of a commitment to get off the range and get and spend more time at the short game area and more time putting. Getting my swing together has been, I mean, it's been a joy, honestly, to work on it. But the gains I've made have been great and I want to keep going, but not to the exclusion of other stuff where my scoring's going to improve. And that means way more short game and way more putting than I've been doing. And that's just sort of, I prioritized some things correctly at first, but now I need to reprioritize and go to these other areas. Cause I, if I think that somehow I'm, getting better at the swing, my full swing, what I think I got putting knocked, like I don't, and I'm not going to figure that on my own either.
Have you experienced this? I've seen this the last few months, how I've actually been shocked by how active my ego has been, even at the driving range. I know nobody next to me. I'm never going to see this person again on my right. I'm never going to see the person again on my left. But let's say I'm on lesson two, right? And I was working on some new drill and you feel like a fish out of water. You feel like you're trying something for the first time, which in a lot of cases we are. And I was shanking it or I was snap hooking it and I was doing things that I haven't been used to doing. And my ego was so active in my head to want to switch everything and go into fix mode just so that I can, and not even consciously, it was more subconsciously, show the person to my left and right that I'm not as bad as I look. Did you ever go through that type of thing where you wanted to kind of throw everything out as you were starting the process in your lessons? And was it tough to fight through the relearning process?
It used to be. I think it used to be. Like you years ago, before this whole back thing happened for me, like in 2019 or 2018, whenever it started, I would take a lesson and feel like, okay, I took the lesson and then I'm okay. And then if things got bad to the point where I felt like I needed to go, that's not a long-term fix. That's not what I would never do that in the basketball context. I would never like talk to a coach for a day and then, all right, I'm good. You wouldn't do that. And especially in golf. But I think the freeing thing for me was I surrendered. Like I basically said, I'm waving the white flag. Let's start over. I'll do whatever you say and whatever it takes. And I did, and I have been, and I still am. I mean, I got a lesson today. And I had a day where I don't have to travel and I can get in there for an hour and a half. I'm going. And good, bad, or indifferent, I got a chance to get better and I'm going to take it. And then when I was younger, off season, the golf off season is my basketball season. I can't play during the basketball season, but that doesn't mean I can't take a day and go in and take a lesson or go hit balls for an hour or something. But I never did that when I was younger. It was, I played during my golf season and I didn't play when it wasn't my golf season. And I'm not young enough to be able to do that anymore. I got to have something going on the whole year if I'm going to maintain anything and, or God forbid, get better. And I've improved on that too. I've made it a priority.
So what happened to walk me through Cherry Hills? What was the magic that happened at Cherry Hills?
Jack Fields is the magic. So this Cherry Hills tournament, the former pro at Charlotte Country Club, Andrew Shuck, became the pro at Cherry Hills in Denver. And I think it was Peyton Manning and some others wanted to get a tournament together that they had before that I think it had stopped for a period of time. Might have been the pandemic when it stopped, but it's called the Smith Cole, named after their legendary pros that they've had there at Cherry Hills. And so Andrew reached out to Jack and to me are you guys willing to come play? And I'm like, absolutely. You know, I had played at Cherry Hills. I'm like, I'll crawl on my knees to play there again. Mm-hmm. So we went out there, Jack, it's a tiered tournament. So the pros play against each other and then you and your pro play against the field. And then you also have a division where you play with Cherry members, you know, that you play with. So it's you and it's me and Jack at Charlotte Country Club playing with two Cherry members. And there's a whole bunch of stuff going on. And Jack is a magnificent golfer. I mean, it's just a pleasure to watch him hit a ball. He's tiny and knocks the crap out of it and not afraid of anything. Mm-hmm. And so I help on the stroke holes or God forbid, I make a birdie or something like that on another hole, I can help. But basically, I'm just riding shotgun with Jack. And I think we finished second or third last year. And then this year we won the thing. And it's so much fun, like to go out there and they're great people. And so you enjoy the fellowship, I guess you call it, just hanging out with really good guys. And then when it's time to get competitive, you play and you hope you play well. But it's what golf at my age is supposed to be. I just have a blast doing that.
Do you find that you're freer playing with a guy like that? Or do you find that you put more pressure on yourself on the stroke holes to contribute?
A little bit of both, but it's way freer knowing that you've got, like, Jack pars or birdies every single hole. Like, he might've made a bogey or two along the way because Cherry's a difficult golf course, but it wasn't very many. Like, he's shooting 69 or 68 or whatever he shot. And one day, this crazy wind where they had the pin position set the same as the 1960 Open that Arnold Palmer won. That was impossible that day. It was so hard.
That's cool.
And it was really cool. And what was really cool was the first in the practice round on the first hole, they had a dozen persimmon drivers and a bunch of a lot of golf balls. And they asked everybody to, you know, take a swing and try to hit the green. I took a swing with it, and I hit it pretty damn well for me. And the sound it made was unbelievable. I'd forgotten that from when I was a kid, that that's what golf sounded like. And
what does it sound like? How do you describe it?
Sounded like I was hitting a grapefruit relative to today's technology. You know, you're hitting it with a persimmon driver when they say hit it on the screws, and that actually meant there are screws in the middle of the golf club.
Right.
But it's not like today where you hear this metallic thing hitting hitting these different, you know, Pro V1 or something. It's the sound is way, way different. And you could kind of feel the golf ball compressing. You know, those were back in the days. Like, I don't even know if you can knock one of these new balls out of round. But if you look back, like, that was an issue playing a lot of golf ball. Like, you could knock it out of round. You know, that doesn't happen. You never hear that anymore. Maybe it happens, but it doesn't happen for me. I could play those balls forever, knock them out, you know, never be knocked out of round. But it was really cool. And then you could see how far you had to hit that damn thing. Because, you know, even for a guy like me, if I tag one, you know, I could be around that green, if not make it, but you ain't making it. There's no way I was going to hit it that far with persimmon and a Bellotta golf ball, and Arnold Palmer did it. I mean, it's ridiculous.
That sounds amazing. Now I want to go do it. I'm going to Sand Valley soon in Wisconsin, and they let you rent hickories out whenever you want. So I might have to do that. But you talked about, Jay, how your enjoyment level has skyrocketed. That's a big mission of this show, is helping frustrated golfers enjoy the ride again. So I want to get clear on what's contributed to that. Can I take a guess
sure.
before you answer? How much of an impact has removing the guesswork and the trying to figure out what you're doing wrong led to increasing your enjoyment? Meaning, when you make a mistake, it seems like after taking a lesson a week for a year, you probably have a pretty good education of what you do and why you do it, especially when you do it poorly. How has that helped? Obviously, hitting more solid shots will feel better, and that's an amazing thing. But what do you think's led to that? Do you connect with removing the guesswork at all?
Yes, that's basically exactly what it is, that yeah. I'm better, at least for me. I'm not comparing myself to real players because I know I'm not a real golfer. But when you...
Four handicap's pretty good, Jay.
It's pretty... Look, but I play in that American Century tournament. They've been kind enough to invite me the last several years and hopefully into the future, but I will not be surprised when my phone doesn't ring one year. But, you know, there are 5 to 10 guys at my club that could win that without breaking a sweat. And I think that's true of just about every club. There are guys at your club that played high level competitive golf. And, you know, it just shows you how hard it is to make the PGA Tour. You're talking about, what, 125 people that make the PGA Tour. I mean, there are way more than that in the NBA. And, you know, I was a pretty good basketball player. I got drafted, but I played overseas. So I was in a, you know, I was a good player. But I mean, there are countless guys that are playing at your local club that would kick my ass in those things. I'm not a real golfer in that sense. But to your earlier question, going out and feeling like I know what I'm doing, at least for me, is freeing. So if I make a mistake, I know how to deal with it. And obviously, like, my scores have gotten better. And then on my bad days, my scores are way better.
Mm.
I just want to get to a point where I eliminate kind of the, what I would call the dumb mistakes that cost me a double instead of a bogey, or, you know, things like that. Like stepping up to a par five and going, how many times am I going to eagle this thing? Like, let's get realistic here. I make more birdies on par fives when I hit a average or below tee shot. It's amazing. When I hit it great, I'm thinking about doing something great instead of
get excited.
Look, I'm in good shape. Like, why do I have to make eagle here? Like, hit the shot that makes sense on your second shot. I don't have to take unnecessary risk here and put myself in a bad position. So I've eliminated bigger scores now, and playing better makes you feel better. It's just more fun to play well. And then when it's not your day, because you're not going to play well all the time. When it's not your day, I can limit the damage that would have really frustrated me 5 years ago.
Totally. Well, I actually did what you described in front of your childhood buddy, Steve. So I have no pressure when I play with Steve again. I have no pressure again because I made eagle in front of Steve. I hit a 3 wood to 3 feet and we were all going nuts. But Steve said, I got to follow this. What am I? He didn't know what to do. It was great. But let's talk about your putting, Jay. What's going on with your putting? Let's figure this out together.
Well, I've worked on it, but I was a pretty competent putter for quite a while, where, you know, I felt like, you know, I stepped over a putt and I felt like not only can I make this, I'm taking it to make it. And it was, frankly, it was tournament golf that did it to me. I missed some putts that I should have made and I let it get into my head a little bit. And I saw my pro and made a couple changes and all that. And I've been tension filled for a long time now, for it's been about a year and a half. And I feel like I'm turning a corner and getting out of it. So it's been better, but it's been the short putt stuff, like the 3-4 footers that you think, what am I sweating over? It's not that big of a deal. I'm just putting myself in a position where I'm missing those, you know, I'm missing too many of them. And then, you know, you let it bother you, you carry it to the next tee. So it's a mental thing for me. It's not really, it's just like, just hit the damn putt. It's not that hard. Yeah. And let's take the, I've been carrying this baggage around with putting for over a year now. It's time for me to put the bags down and just take the putt and accept make or miss. Just take the putt to make it and don't worry about it. I'm getting better at that. So it's improved over the last few months. But I at that American Century this year, I hit the ball really well overall. I putted horribly, horribly. And like, I don't know if you remember this. So Steph Curry won the tournament and on 18, he hit a drive and knocked it to, I don't know, 10 feet to the right of the pin on 18 and knocks it in for eagle. All right. Now I was playing a lot earlier because my score wasn't as good as his. I hit it. I hit my drive, then hit an 8-iron in. I hit it to the exact same spot. I don't think we were more than a foot difference one way or the other. And I 3-jacked it and made a par. And I walked off there thinking, what the hell did you just do? You know, it's that kind of thing that I did all day long. I turned pars into bogeys. I turned birdies into pars. And I turned bogeys into doubles. Because I could not figure it out. Like I'd be short on one, long on another. Nothing was consistent. And it was incredibly frustrating. And then for me, when you know, that was the extreme of sort of bad putting and getting into my head. But when that happened, then I could feel myself thinking about hitting the ball closer with my irons. And I'm like, what are you doing? And I was mired in it and I couldn't get out of it. It was really, really frustrating. It was incredibly fun, but really frustrating at the same time.
All right, stay seated, keep that seatbelt fast, and the train's gonna make a quick stop. But first, I just wanted to say, I've been thinking a lot about, guys, what the whole purpose of this podcast, our social medias, everything that we do, what is really the purpose? Why does it exist? And it's genuinely to help frustrated golfers enjoy the game more and help you with enjoyment on the course and off the course. If we're going to do stuff that we say we love, be with the people we say we want to spend time with, and we're not enjoying it, what are we doing? What's the purpose? So that's the point, is to use golf as a way to help us enjoy the shit we like, right? Enjoy it more and maybe limit the frustration, decrease the frustration. So as a big part of that, YouTube is my new focus. Obviously, the podcast will always be a focus, number one. But YouTube, we're putting a lot into it, and I'm trying to help frustrated golfers enjoy the ride in new ways. So hop over to our YouTube channel, At The Par Train, youtube.com/@thepartrain. Give us a subscribe, slide into the comments, let us know what you want to see, and I want to create the happiest group of people on the planet that happen to play golf. That's the goal. So hop over to our YouTube channel. We'll see you over there. Let's get back to the show.
It's funny how when your ball striking improves, it can expose other parts of your game that historically never presented an issue, right? And it's you experienced with your putting what I experienced with my ball striking and my driver specifically, where you start to, I actually flew to Alabama to see Dr. Brett McCabe, who's coached John Rahm, Billy Horschel, Brian Harman, many of the guys on the PGA Tour. And he talked to me, he sat me down in his club after we went out and I was hoping to be fixed, right? And actually he told me, I don't think you have the swing yips. I think you have a swing issue and you need help from a coach, which is what sparked this journey in 2024. But he said, what happens is if you don't have a foundation of this is what I do and this is what I do well and this is what I do when I mess up and I know how to fix it, and you just keep trying to fix it up here and you keep messing up, your self-image will just get beat up. And then the more you do it, the more it becomes a thing. And that's when it can get into trouble, when self-image is tied to something that's seemingly easy. And then the comparison comes into play and other people are doing it that are no near the golfer you are, but it's easy for them. I see a 15 handicap, hit it down the middle. And I'm like, how did he do that? Like, I can't hit it in the middle if I got paid, you know, like it doesn't make any sense to me. The second that you can start to break away from that and start to get clear on what do I have to do, that's when it can start to change. Let me tell you a quick story, Jay, about what I learned from a putting coach on the show. He said, he asked me, are you allowed to pick up the ball and put it in the hole? And I said, what do you mean? He goes, can you physically put the ball in the hole? Is that allowed? I go, well, I guess not. I have to putt it there. So no, I can't put it in the hole. So he goes, so when they say put it in the hole, that doesn't make any sense because you're not allowed to. What are you allowed to do? Get it started, right? So his big thing was change your job. He asked me, Evan, can you roll this ball over that spot an inch in front of your ball? Can you do that? Do you feel pretty good about your ability to do that? I was like, yeah, that's not that hard. Right. And he goes, well, then if you roll your ball over that spot at the speed that you wanted, you made your putt. That's a make. Making is different than holing. Holing is not your job. You have no control over whether that putt goes in. Have you made a putt that was off the heel that went in? Yes. Have you made a putt that was perfect that didn't go in? Yes. So you can't hole it. So that kind of changed my mentality on the greens of trying to make the putt, but making the putt was all about getting started. What comes up for you when you hear that analogy?
I think about it the same way. Like, I understand that kind of every, or at least I think I do, for me, you know, every putt's basically a 4-inch putt. You know, you get it started at the right speed, right line, and all that. But my issue has come in kind of short, long dispersion there. You know, what I'm really trying to do now is, like, I want to avoid 3 putts. Like, you know, if I don't make the first one, I want to be in a position where making the second one isn't a concern.
Right.
And, you know, I don't want to, like, when I'm playing with my friends, I don't want to slow the round down by saying, look, I need to putt these 2 footers, stuff like that. But I got to get out of the, you know, I left myself a 4-footer coming back on a putt. Or, you know, sometimes I get stuck in this thing of like having a relatively short putt and putting it with touch, or, you know, banging it in the hole like the pros do. I don't think I'm a bang it in the hole guy. Like, for me, that's not a comfortable feeling, because man, I missed one of those. And then I got a putt that's worse coming back, depending on the putt. But it's all a mental thing for me. Like, I think, like your point earlier about of iron play. So when I'm hitting the ball well, which I have been lately, for me, my score expectation goes up. Mm-hmm. And And then now I'm putting more pressure on putting. Why? What? And for some reason, when I'm putting, like one of the things that occurred to me in the because I heard John Lester's caddy tell him this, he was like aggressive on the birdie putts, conservative on the par putts. And I was like, why didn't I hear him say that on the first hole? Like, I think he said it to him, later in the round. And that's a Stableford system, so you obviously score more. It's zero for a bogey, one for a par, and three for a birdie. So be aggressive on your birdie putts to make it, because the points are different. But you got a par putt, like, don't be stupid. Don't put yourself in a position to double this thing, because bogey doesn't hurt you. Like, just be smart on those. And I wish I had heard that, because I was tentative on my birdie putts because I wanted to make sure I left with something. Don't take par out of this. And I probably screwed myself on that, 18th hole, because I was really aggressive on that eagle putt. And then I wound up leaving with a par. But I should have left with at worst a birdie.
Yeah, I heard from Parker McLaughlin on the show, the short game chef. I don't know if you follow him, short game coach on tour. He told me that it's been actually pretty clear because he was one of the best putters in his day. And I loved, if you haven't listened to that, I'll send you the link. You will absolutely get a ton out of our episode of him talking about putting the whole time. But the way that he thinks about putting is actually really refreshing because someone like you and your experience, putting can be such a, you talked about tension, right? Enemy of performance. It can be such a fear-driven thing. When Parker, and you'll probably laugh at this experiencing the other side of it, Parker would walk up to the green and he'd be filled with excitement because this is his time to complete the hole, right? It was his time to kind of feel creative and complete the picture. But he told me, it's been pretty simple. Anytime he putted poorly, he focused on his stroke. Anytime he was putting well, he wasn't. Do you get stroke bound, or is it more a speed issue for you?
It's probably a combination of it. I don't know if this explains it or eliminates it a little bit better, but and this has been going on with me from the time I really started playing seriously, where it was a passionate thing for me. I hit my best shots without question. My best shots are when I lay up on a par five. It's not even close. I like when I'm laying up on a par five, where I'm not worried about how far I hit it and all that, I flush it and I wind up hitting it further than I expected. More often than not, I hit shitty shots there too. But those are some of my best shots because I'm not like aiming at anything or, my expectations are low. I'm laying up. And that's a mental thing. It's clearly a mental thing. Like I'm allowing myself to execute something there without major concern. I'm like, well, why am I worried about it? That green's really big. And if I got a wedge in my hands and I knock it to 15 feet, and what, that's bad? Like, what, why am I worried about this? I don't have to do anything spectacular. And I'm trying to get the, expectation level realistic of look, if I got a wedge in my hands, I don't want to knock it into a bunker, but if I get it on the green, that's pretty good. Like let's take the expectations out of it. And my putting expectations are, I know what I'm doing. I just got to stop doing it. I'm carrying negativity with me. I've been struggling putting, and I'm expecting a struggle when I get there, when I get up to the green. Even if I hit the two best shots of my life leading in there, my expectation after hitting two great shots for me is a really good score on this hole. And then I go, okay, the only thing standing between a really good score on this hole and me is how I putt this. Like, why am I dragging that around? And I just got to get myself out of that kind of thing. And talking about it afterwards, I know it, but I got to be able to start doing it in the moment better and reminding myself throughout the round that, look, like this is not that big of a deal. Like don't carry this, like put these bags down. I don't need to carry this baggage around with me.
Well, it's probably pretty easy to demonize putting if you put a year plus of getting lessons. You lowered your handicap. You're hitting it better than ever. And there's that little demon, that the one thing holding you back from going lower, right? It feels bad because we put the meaning to it, right? It's not the missing the putts. It's that the putts is preventing us from getting better. It's the Achilles heel feeling. But you even told us last time, Jay, I listened to it this morning. You said you never leave a huddle in other sports and yell, don't lose.
Right.
You yell win, because you do everything you can to win without being afraid of the outcome, right? But 2-foot putts, kind of like a free throw, to your point, it can bring about other points of tension because there's this expectation that I should make this, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a different feeling that I've ever had, because like in a basketball game, if you're not, you know, if you're not making a specific kind of shot, you're not hitting your jumper or something, you can adjust and drive it or get close to the basket, get an offensive rebound, you know, do some different things that are going to put points on the board. In golf, you know, they don't tell you, hey, if you're struggling with your tee shot, just take it out in the fairway and just start on your second shot. You got to hit it, you know, and so there's no choice involved in that. There's no adjustment you can make in that regard. And for, you know, the golfer like me with my level of understanding of the game, which is far less than what I call real golfers, it's a lot harder for me to make that adjustment in the moment. You know, you push one right, and then, you know, you don't want to overcompensate. Now all of a sudden you got a two-way miss. Those things get in our heads a lot easier, a lot more quickly than it does in a, you know, a real golfer's head.
Totally. Well, I know we got about 9 minutes left. I want to hit some basketball/other sport questions before we leave, but I want you to keep me posted on the putting stuff. I'm going to send you that podcast. I'm interested to follow the journey so we can get you even lower. I wanted to talk quickly about the power of money in the sense of kind of seeing two things happen concurrently. You've got Liv on the golf side that doesn't necessarily translate to better for the fans. And then you've got NIL, which is great for the athletes. But I was talking to my buddies, I can't remember, and this is a football example with college football, but I can't remember a time where the best players in a huge bowl game weren't playing because they didn't want to get hurt and they didn't really need to play, right? They're going to the draft, like the Florida State example. How is your view on that? The more money going in to something might not actually translate a better product for the fans?
I think it comes down to, I don't think people really care how much money athletes are paid. I don't think they really care.
Yeah.
You change their system. You change the delivery system to them. That's when they care. And right now in college sports, fans don't care whether college athletes are paid and how much they get. They may talk about it because it's a topic. They may say they care, but they're still watching, still consuming it the same way. But when the system gets changed, so all of a sudden now Florida State has no chance after a decision is made by a committee to win a national championship. You know, so there's incredible disappointment. And the players are like, I don't want to play in this meaningless bowl game. Like, right. I'm putting myself at risk of getting hurt. You know, now the old school way of thinking about it is, hey, you know, people have played in the Orange Bowl or whatever bowl it was for years. It's an honor and all that stuff. They're going, so everybody's making money off this except us, and we're putting our bodies at risk. I understand the decision not to play.
Sure.
Now that is going to change. But they expect you to go play in these quote unquote, what I consider to be meaningless bowl games. And they expect guys to go out and play. And look, if they want to, great. But nobody asked the players, do you want to play in this? Florida State accepted that invitation because there's a lot of money in that. And the system makes a lot of money in it. But the same thing with LIV Golf and the PGA Tour. You know, the fans are important. They don't care how much the purse is. They want to know who's going to win the Masters. They want to watch the best players compete in the U.S. Open. But as long as those stay the same, I think this can work out pretty well. I can tell you candidly, I did not believe at the time that the way this entire matter was handled was probably the best thing. You know, my thing would have been for the PGA Tour when LIV started is, you want to go? Go. But here's how many events you have to play on to keep your card. Because I figured, maybe I was wrong, but at the time I thought there's no way that the majors are going to tell LIV players they can't play.
Right.
Like how's Augusta National going to tell former champions you can't play because of a business decision you made that we don't agree with?
Right.
How can you call it the Open Championship or the US Open if it's not open?
Mm-hmm.
And now whatever the PGA decided to do, that might be a little bit different, but they were going to play in my view. So why go through all this? It didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Sometimes you can win a legal case and lose overall, but hopefully it'll work out. But I never really thought, you know, that the fan engagement would be as important as it is in golf, that, you know, you really, it's a particular fan base, and tradition is important. Although I heard somebody from the RNA say something during the Open Championship that I will never forget. That gentleman said, tradition is only important if it's useful to the present. And I thought, man, that's really good. Like, you know, there are all kinds of traditions in golf. Some of them, frankly, don't make sense anymore. They're not useful to the present. But the ones that are, we should hold on to. And I don't know whether some of these smaller tournaments on the PGA Tour will be worth it in the future. I have no idea. But there's a framework that's going to work for everybody. And the LIV thing is not going to go away. So everybody needs to adjust.
Yeah, and with the NCAA tournament coming up, I wanted to ask you, it's so funny as, you know, I used to work at the NFL. I'm from St. Louis. I'm a big sports fan. But as I've gotten older, the amount of games I watch has significantly decreased. And so I just wanted, I don't think there's anyone better to ask this than you. How the hell do I pick a bracket if I've lost touch with what's going on in college basketball? Do I just need to watch you and take your picks? Or do I need to take my wife's strategy of you pick the mascots? Well, like, what am I doing, Jay? How do I pick it now?
Well, whatever's the most fun, because I have no idea who's going to win these games. You know, I have a clue, but I don't really know. And people think that we should know. And you can't pick the NFL playoffs. You can't tell who's going to win a golf tournament. You know, maybe back in the day when Tiger and Jack were dominating, you could have an idea, but you really don't know. And this bracket thing's taken on this life. I do a bracket every year because ESPN makes me do it. And I step up there and I tell people what I think may happen in particular games. But, and I can't give a disclaimer every time going, look, if I really knew who's going to win this game, I wouldn't even be doing this job. I'd be in Vegas betting on these games and sitting by the pool with a drink in my hand waiting to get paid. I don't know. Nobody knows. So I do the bracket and I don't even think about it until the tournament's over. Because, I mean, I just process the games and analyze them and do what I'm supposed to do. I'm not sitting there going, God, I hope my bracket's good. I don't really care.
Yeah.
And I think it's something you do. It's enjoyable. It's fun. But anybody that thinks they can predict this accurately, they're crazy. They're crazy. And you can use analytics and be a little bit better. You can put yourself in a better position. What I would do is go to some of these sites like KenPom.com. Look at how the teams are rated offensively and defensively. And there are sites out there where it'll tell you within this range, you can pick a champion. So from this group of teams, traditionally, this is where the champions come from. But that's not going to tell you that Fairleigh Dickinson's going to beat Purdue last year. There's no way that anybody in their right mind would have predicted that. That's where somebody picking the mascots or letting your dog choose based on, you know, picking which treat they go to, you know, with two options, you know, they're going to do better in that game than you are.
So what's it going to take for my Arizona Wildcats to finally get over the hump and win? Obviously, I know they've won before, but I was much younger. I didn't follow them then. Since I've been an alum, they've been the one team. I've been lucky. I've seen a World Series. I've seen a Super Bowl. I've seen a Stanley Cup with the Blues, and I haven't seen my Wildcats win the tournament. What's going to get them over the hump?
They're good enough to do it this year. And they were good enough last year, but they weren't as good defensively last year as they are this year. they're legit, and they're one of the top, I think, three, four teams in the country without much question. They should be a number one seed unless they fall down significantly down the stretch. The other team that can get in there is Tennessee, who's really good. But I like the way they play. And Tommy Lloyd, their coach, is outstanding. So they got it. They've got a real shot to win it this year. Last year, they ran into a bad matchup, didn't play well against Princeton. I don't anticipate that happening this year. I think they've got better players overall than they had last year. And I think they're tougher, both mentally and physically. So I think they've got a great shot to do it. But if they do, you should go, because there are two events I've been to in my life that I think are the best sporting events. One is the Ryder Cup, and the other is the Final Four. Because the Final Four, you get three games, and whether your team wins or loses, that Saturday of the Final Four is awesome. It's awesome. It's a 3 or 4 day party for fans, and there's nothing like it. And it's hard for me to say this, because you know I've been to so many Final Fours. There's a part of it that's a little bit routine for me, and making this, but if I only had one sporting event to go to the rest of my life where I could attend it as a fan, I would choose the Ryder Cup.
Love that.
It was
the Ryder Cup's amazing.
Unbelievable. I went in 08 at Valhalla, and I could not get enough of it. I thought it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen.
100%. Well, I'm going to leave you with this. I ask this to every guest. Going back to our golf conversation and all this progress you've made of enjoying the game, improving your game, what is something we talked about that you want to either reiterate and leave people with so that they can enjoy and improve their game? Or is there anything we didn't cover that you think is important to state before we go?
No, I mean, all I would say, Evan, is like, I think for me, golf is about enjoyment. And obviously it's more enjoyable when you play well. And when you feel like, hey, I'm getting better, all that stuff. But for me, you know, playing well is a very selfish thing. Like I want to play well for me. The beauty of this for me is there's no other sport that I play, that I have played, where I get to enjoy the people I'm with, like golf. And golf is like, I'm selfish. Like what I'm trying to do is be selfish in the moment for my play when it's my turn to hit. And then the rest of the time, I want to be social and enjoy it. And if I get frustrated on the selfish part, I'm ruining the social part. The amount of time you spend actually hitting a golf ball and around a golf, what does it take? 5 minutes in 4 hours?
Yeah.
And I'm not going to let the 5 minutes that action ruin the other 3 hours and 55 minutes of enjoying the people I'm with.
Love that. Well, Jay, thanks again for hopping aboard the Partrain, your second ride. Keep us posted on the putting. Have a great Final Four and tournament coming up. And I'll have to keep you posted about my round with Steve next time I play with him.
Keep me posted. Let's get out there and play.
Absolutely. You let me know when you're coming back to SoCal and we'll get it on the calendar.
I'll be there in July.
Sounds good. Thanks,
Jay.
All
right, brother.
All right, take care.
Thanks for hopping aboard, guys. Before you hop off the train, I think I got something you're going to love. Our new YouTube channel is growing fast. It's something I'm putting a lot of focus and time and my heart into. So if you guys like the podcast, our YouTube is going to come out with the video podcast of the audio version every Monday on our YouTube channel, as well as more and more videos to help you enjoy the ride and keep your game on track. So go to youtube.com/@thepartrain or just search the Partrain on the YouTubes, and hopefully we can keep riding this train together. Thanks again for hopping aboard. Hope you guys enjoy the ride.